on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Well, as coronavirus still dominates the news, I'm searching for you to find news of other things that we can talk about, because obviously there are other health conditions that we need to know about that are still going on in this day and age. And yes, the virus is still very much with us and we need to be aware of that, but we also need to take care of our health in other ways. So I'm going to start off with the usual news roundup, and then we're going to have a think about the menopause this evening and how you can beat the menopause. But first of all, our news roundup, which does again contain some COVID news. Apparently, blood pressure medication is one factor that's making the COVID-19 virus more dangerous. The drugs increase the chances of viral pneumonia and fatal respiratory failure, new research has discovered. People who are taking an ACE inhibitor or an ARB drug for heart problems should stay at home and not meet up with people. That's according to researchers from Louisiana State University. People taking one of these drugs are four times apparently more likely to die from the virus, and the drugs also increase the chances of catching the virus in the first place. ACE inhibitors, in particular, increase the levels of receptors around the lungs that the coronavirus binds to, and many taking the medication are elderly, and they're being treated for cardiovascular diseases, including a heart attack, high blood pressure, hypertension, diabetes, or chronic kidney disease. The ARBs are also prescribed to reduce blood pressure levels. Data from just over 1,000 COVID-19 patients in China shows that most were also suffering from hypertension, coronary artery disease, diabetes, and renal disease, all health problems that were likely being treated with one of the drugs. Similar reports have been coming out of Italy, where an estimated 52% of COVID fatalities also involve people who were taking an ACE inhibitor. This could also explain why children don't seem to be infected by the virus. They have fewer ACE receptors in their lower respiratory tracts, say the researchers. And ginkgo biloba is a potential therapy to combat the virus, say scientists. Its antiviral properties have been tested successfully on several viruses, including the herpes virus and Zika, and it could be just as effective against the new coronavirus. In laboratory trials, researchers at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago discovered that ginkgolic acid derived from ginkgo leaves and fruits either blocks or slows down the development of several viruses, and they think it could also be effective against the coronavirus. Ginkgo biloba is a herbal medicine that's been used in the West since the 16th century, mainly for improving memory and reducing anxiety. Doctors warn that it interacts with a range of prescription drugs, including aspirin and SSRI antidepressants. And a group of hospitals in New York have treated its most critical COVID-19 patients with high doses of vitamin C. The patients who received vitamin C did significantly better than those who didn't get vitamin C. That's according to specialists within Northwell Health, which runs 23 hospitals in New York State, including Lenox Hill Hospital in Manhattan. The patients are being given doses of 1,500 milligrams 3 to 4 times a day, which is 16 times the recommended daily allowance of 90 grams for men, milligrams for men, and 75 milligrams for women. Now, the positive results coming out of hospitals in China, where the coronavirus epidemic started, was an inspiration to trial the same therapy. It seems to help a lot, but it's not highlighted because it's not kind of a fashionable drug. One of the medics at Ruijin Hospital in Shanghai treated just over 300 COVID-19 patients in critical care units with high doses of vitamin C every day for 10 days, and none of them died. And Chinese doctors have been using high-dose vitamin C for years to treat a range of health problems, including sepsis, pancreatitis, and surgical wound healing. And so, apparently these are not the only, the American doctors as well, not the only doctors administering high doses of vitamin C. And a spokesman said it's being used widely, although the exact dose is decided by each clinician. So there's no particular amount to be given. But extra vitamin C, I think I said that to you quite some time ago, actually, is always worth giving it a go. And anti-malarial drugs have been touted as an answer to the COVID-19 infection. And President Trump, can we rely on his information there? But he has described them as a game changer, but they can cause life-threatening heart problems. A new study of chloroquine was stopped suddenly after two patients died from an irregular heart rate known as ventricular tachycardia. Now, researchers from Brazil had planned on a major trial involving just over 400 people infected with COVID-19, but started to see very worrying reactions to high doses of the drug amongst the first 80 patients who were being tested. And within a few days of starting, many given the high doses, 600 milligrams twice a day for 10 days, started suffering heart rhythm problems and two died. So writing in their database, researchers warned that chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, another anti-malarial, are not safe or effective therapies against the virus. And a COVID-19 patient hospitalised in France also died after developing irregular heart rhythms. Now, aside from heart problems, the anti-malarials cause a host of other life-threatening reactions. That's according to researchers at the Sunnybrook Health Centre of Sciences in Toronto. These include hypoglycemia, which is a sudden drop in blood sugar, confusion, hallucinations and paranoia. And there's very little evidence that suggests the drugs can treat COVID-19 infection. In fact, the anti-malarials may even make the symptoms more severe, despite optimism and even enthusiasm that they're the solution. So maybe President Trump's advice wasn't quite so good after all. And filtered coffee, it's not necessarily the most favourite choice amongst coffee drinkers, but filtered could be the best variety when it comes to the health of our heart. In fact, drinking a daily cup is better for us than not drinking coffee at all. Filtered coffee drinkers have a 15% reduced risk of death from any cause, and they also have a lower risk of dying from heart disease, reduced by 12% in men and 20% for women. Drinking any other type of coffee didn't have any impact on heart disease risk, except for men aged 60 and over, whose risk rose slightly if they weren't drinking filtered coffee. Around 30 years ago, researchers had believed that coffee drinking raised levels of cholesterol, and especially bad LDL cholesterol, but the offending substances could be filtered out. And picking up this theme, researchers at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden wanted to find out if coffee actually increased the chances of a heart attack or heart disease. And they studied the coffee drinking habits of just over 500,000 Swedish people for nearly 20 years, during which time just over 46,000 participants died, including nearly 13,000 from heart disease and 6,000 from a heart attack. But coffee wasn't the culprit. For people who know they have a high cholesterol level and want to do something about it, it's probably best to stay away from unfiltered, including coffee made from a cafetiere. For everyone else, you know, have some coffee, go for filtered. It seems to be the best one for you. And the high protein, low carb ketogenic diet could be the answer to asthma. It stops the airways from becoming inflamed, which causes the distressing symptoms of asthma where the sufferer can't breathe properly. The diet stops the immune system from overreacting to allergens that cause severe inflammation of the respiratory tract. That's according to researchers at the University of Bonn. The ketogenic diet is already used to treat epilepsy and some cancers, and the researchers believe it could also help those with asthma. The biological processes that cause an asthma attack were only fully understood a few years ago with the discovery of cells in the immune system called innate lymphoid cells, or ILCs. They help protect the lungs by regenerating damaged mucous membranes, but the reaction is much stronger in people with asthma, and this causes breathing problems that can be even life-threatening. Now, the researchers think that the ketogenic diet shows the ILC response by changing the way the cells get their energy. The high-fat diet slows the speed at which ILCs grow, and the lack of glucose derived from carbohydrates also affects their development. And normally an allergen would cause the number of ILCs in the bronchi to increase fourfold, and it can be many times that in asthma sufferers. And one of the researchers thinks the case in rises of asthma may be the result of a diet of processed foods which are high in sugars. And cannabis could be the answer to the antibiotic-resistant superbugs. Its cannabidiol compound supercharges antibiotics to make them effective once again. And when combined with CBD, lower doses of antibiotics are proving to be effective when previously even very high doses were not killing bacteria. This combination can kill Staphylococcus aureus, a bacteria responsible for many hospital-acquired infections, which has taken on the status of a superbug after proving resistant to several different classes of antibiotics. In laboratory tests, researchers from the University of Southern Denmark discovered the combination of CBD with the antibiotic bacitracin was able to stop the bacteria from dividing and developing. The cell membranes of the bacteria also became unstable, allowing the antibiotic to do its work. And finally, did you know that over 80% of women and 95% of men over the age of 70 and 40% to 60% of younger age groups are chronically dehydrated? Aim to drink about half your body weight in pounds in ounces of still or sparkling water, equivalent to a litre for every 30 kilograms. So in other words, just drink plenty of water. Okay, we're going to have a little break now, and after the break, I shall be back talking to you about the menopause today. Stay tuned for more after this.
Bye.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Menopause is a huge problem for many women of a certain age. Menopausal symptoms like hot flushes, a brain fog, tiredness. There's all sorts of things that go along with it. And it's been really uncertain as to what to do. I mean, the only FDA-approved method of treating hot flushes is hormone replacement therapy. And HRT fell out of favour after the Women's Health Initiative, the study that was supposed to prove the safety of HRT, was stopped prematurely when those taking the drug demonstrated an increased incidence of cancer. But it's now having a little bit of a revival, with newspapers awash with new studies supposedly showing its benefits and safety. But most menopausal symptoms can be sorted out through diet. So what can you do to help ease your menopausal symptoms? So one of the main things about the menopause is hot flashes, isn't it? So there are many studies showing a diet rich in soy and isoflavones can decrease the occurrence of hot flashes. And in one study, a group consuming 60 grams of soy protein powder daily reported a 45% decrease in the number of daily hot flashes after 3 months. And a recent review of studies has shown that soy isoflavones decrease the frequency of hot flashes, especially in women with more frequent episodes. The isoflavones, genistein, diazine and glycitin contained in soy are known as phytoestrogens or plant estrogens because they act like a weaker version of estrogen in the body with the potential to bind to estrogen receptors. However, because of this estrogen binding potential, there are debates as to whether or not these phytoestrogens increase cancer risks in postmenopausal women. So, soy could be potentially harmful to the thyroid by interfering with the absorption of thyroid hormones. And many soy products use genetically modified plants as well. And also in Asian cultures, soy is used as a condiment rather than a food. And Asian cultures use about 2 teaspoons per day fermented soy versus the unfermented soy foods. Typically in America, 1 or 2 cups a day of soy are consumed. So soy can be added as a healthy part of the menopausal diet, but choose traditional sources like fermented soy in moderation. Good examples of fermented soy products include miso, natto, fermented tofu and fermented soy milk. Also, cut down on foods that increase the incidence of hot flashes. Researchers on the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center recommended cutting caffeine from the diet after finding increased rates of night sweats in women who consume caffeinated drinks. And other studies have shown that in addition to phytoestrogens, vitamin C, vitamin E, and evening primrose oil can help to decrease hot flashes. Now, another one of the symptoms of menopause is insomnia. So we all know that large amounts of caffeine can keep us awake and that we should decrease caffeine consumption before bedtime. But alcohol has also been shown to impair REM, that's rapid eye movement cycles, during sleep. So try lowering your alcohol intake for a more restful night. One study found that carbs can help you sleep. Eating a high glycemic index meal 4 hours before bedtime decreased the time it took for the study participants to fall asleep. However, this approach might not work for women who are trying to avoid carbs for other reasons, such as sticking to a paleo diet. Another cause of reduced sleep is a diet deficient in vitamin B12. So increase your consumption of foods rich in B12, like meat, poultry, fish, eggs and dairy. And also avoid stomach acid inhibitors like Zantac, Pepcid and Prilosec, which can create deficiencies in vitamin B12 due to malabsorption. These strategies can also help to increase the production of L-tryptophan, a precursor to melatonin, the sleep-inducing hormone secreted in your brain before bedtime. If you can increase melatonin at night by eating a meal of slightly carbohydrate nature and increasing foods rich in vitamin B12, that's meats, cheeses and eggs, it may help with sleep induction. And finally, take 400 milligrams of magnesium at bedtime, in along with a chamomile tea or a valerian tea to help sleeping. And another problem of the menopause is weight gain. So some weight gain in menopause may be the body's way of creating its own estrogen. If you were already overweight or obese before menopause, then there may be a need to lose weight. But if you were at a healthy body mass index and gained 2 to 5 kilograms during menopause, it may be normal to allow your body to try and respond naturally to the change. Make sure you balance your meals with lean protein, vegetables and grains with a low GI. Limit sugars and sweeteners and eat healthy fats like olive oil, cold water fish or flax seeds. Limit alcohol and increase exercise. And importantly, realise that you will make mistakes. Don't see them as a cause to give up, but as a teaching aid to help you avoid the same pitfalls in the future. And then, of course, there's the dreaded mood swings, isn't there? Too often, women's mood swings are blamed on hormones. And what's usually absent from the conversation is how foods and certain dietary restrictions can alter mood. Diets low in omega-3 fatty acids may contribute to depressive symptoms. And in this era of low-fat diets, women trying to lose weight may be making menopausal mood symptoms worse. Low levels of the amino acid tryptophan may also play a role in depression. Now, while the data on tryptophan and serotonin production is limited, eating a diet high in spinach and seaweed as well as soy proteins can provide high levels of tryptophan. Not only do women with lower levels of omega-3 fatty acids have higher rates of depression, but the extent of the omega-3 deficiency is correlated with the severity of depression. A comprehensive review of the available data on the subject concluded that 1 gram per day of the omega-3s, as EPAs and DHAs, had a protective effect against mood disorders. Sources of omega-3 include cold water fish, flaxseed, walnuts, soybeans, and green leafy vegetables. Vitamin B6 found in beef, pork, fish, cereals, avocados, bananas and grains has also been shown to improve mood symptoms in PMS. If you suffer from bouts of depression or low mood, also try eating smaller balanced meals 5 to 6 times a day to help stabilise blood sugar levels. Now, if you're not sure whether or not you're menopausal, there is apparently something that is out at the moment that could help you diagnose the menopause. It's a t-shirt, and it's a t-shirt packed with tiny sensors. It's worn around the clock to measure changes in temperature and identify sweating caused by the hot flashes that many menopausal women suffer. The sensors, which sit close to the skin, take readings every 30 seconds, and the results are relayed via a thin wire to a tiny computerized controller sewn into the hem and then transmitted to a doctor's computer via Bluetooth. A scientist behind the invention in China hope it will speed up the diagnosis of the menopause, potentially giving women earlier access to treatment to relieve symptoms such as hormone replacement therapy. Diagnosis can currently take several sometimes distressing years, as common symptoms including depression, mood swings, tiredness and headaches can be put down to weight problems and other lifestyle issues. The menopause occurs when aging ovaries naturally stop producing the hormones estrogen and progesterone, and this causes 3 in 4 women to experience intermittent hot flushes throughout the day, with some even needing to change drenched bed sheets at night. Now, the exact mechanism is not clear, but a drop in estrogen is thought to affect the hypothalamus, the part of the brain that produces hormones and controls body temperature. While the average age that the menopause begins is 51, some women suffer from symptoms as early as 45, while others see no signs until their mid-50s. Numerous factors can account for this variation, including the age a woman's own mother went through the menopause and whether or not she breastfed a baby, which is thought to help preserve ovarian function for longer. While doctors do consider symptoms, their diagnosis is usually based on a patient's age and, crucially, whether she's had a period in the past 12 months. A blood test for high levels of follicle stimulating hormones, which usually indicate reduced ovarian function, is only routinely offered to women under 45 with menopausal symptoms. Scientists at the Chinese University hope the smart T-shirt could help people, women aged 50 and under in particular, get a quicker diagnosis, as their menopausal symptoms can often be attributed to other causes. The ordinary cotton T-shirt is embedded with combined temperature and humidity sensors in areas where women report the worst effects of a hot flush, such as the armpits, abdomen and upper back. The top was tested on 8 middle-aged women who had been experiencing hot flushes for up to 3 years but had not been diagnosed. They wore it continuously while doing different activities, including relaxing on the sofa and going for a walk. And the results that were published showed the T-shirt could accurately track how often hot flushes occurred, as well as their length and intensity. And this gave doctors vital clues on how advanced the menopause was, and larger studies are now planned. Right, we're going to take a little break now, and after the break, I'll be back with you talking about some natural remedies for things, and we're going to have a look at a common problem, which is mouth ulcers. So stay tuned for more after this.
Community Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Just before the break there, I mentioned natural remedies and things that we can do to help ourselves heal a little bit better without resorting to the usual medications. Simple lifestyle changes will often do the trick, but it depends what the problem is. And in particular, mouth ulcers. They're annoying little blighters, aren't they? Up to 2/3 of the world's population suffers with mouth ulcers that keep coming back. They're also known as canker sores or aphthous ulcers, but these can be quite painful and they can be caused by a jagged tooth or overzealous brushing, celiac disease, or even certain prescription drugs as well. But often there's no identifiable cause. But there are some natural remedies and some simple lifestyle changes that could be of benefit to these annoying little things. Well, I say little, they can be really horrible, can't they? I've had mouth ulcers before and it's awful when they crop up. So you could try changing your toothpaste. Sodium lauryl sulfate is a foaming detergent used in many toothpastes, or you might spot it as being called SLS. It could be to blame for recurrent mouth ulcers. A couple of studies have found that people have significantly fewer mouth ulcers when using an SLS-free toothpaste compared to when they use an SLS-containing product. So try making the switch and see if it makes a difference. So Well-Eater, Green People and Ertikram are just a few of the companies offering all natural toothpaste free of SLS and other harsh chemicals. So it could be that you're having a little, almost like an allergic reaction, isn't it, inside your mouth to what's going into your toothpaste. And obviously brushing the toothpaste stays on your teeth all night, doesn't it, if you're brushing in the evenings, which I hope you are. So it could well be that you're having some sort of reaction there. Propolis could be another good thing to use. It's a natural anti-inflammatory and antiseptic. It's a sticky resin connected by bees from leaf buds and tree bark, and it's relied on by many traditional cultures as a mouth ulcer remedy, and there's even some clinical trials to support its use. And in one study, mouth ulcers healed faster in people using topical propolis than those using a placebo. And another study found that taking propolis capsules daily can reduce the frequency of mouth ulcer outbreaks. So there are various different creams that you can get. You can also get it in tablet form as well. Or I've got some that I bought that was in granules. It's kind of nice. You can add it to your breakfast cereal or sprinkle a little bit on salads, you know, so you don't even know you're taking it. Sometimes I know people don't like taking too many pills and tablets and things, but, you know, you can have it in granule form. So give it a go. Again, it's not going to do you any harm, and it may do some good. And a mouthwash of warm water and deglycerinated licorice. Licorice with the glycyrrhizic acid removed healed mouth ulcers within 3 days in the majority of patients in one small trial. Licorice containing patches, which can be placed directly over mouth ulcers, have also proven to be effective. Goodness me, I didn't know I was going to have such a problem saying mouth ulcers. Molsers, I tried to say just then. But anyway, mouth ulcers. DGL is widely available as chewable tablets from brands, popular high street brands, Holland & Barrett, Swanson's. Or you can make your own licorice mouthwash using DGL licorice powder. You can get that on the internet. I think you can also get it in the health shops as well. So it is readily available. So and you can get those licorice sticks as well that you can chew, and they're really good for your teeth. So it may even be that chewing on a licorice stick is a good answer. And I've had those before. They are rather nice. It's a bit like chewing gum, but it's in a stick form. It's wood. It's very natural. And if you're not getting enough B vitamins, especially B12, that has been linked to mouth ulcers as well. So supplementing with a B12 or a B complex vitamin may help. And in one study, B12 supplements prevented mouth ulcer recurrences, even in those without a deficiency in the vitamin. So vitamin B12 is widely available as tablets from health stores and online. Look for methylcobalamin, which is reported to be the most active form, or maybe an oral spray directly onto the ulcers. So that could be good too. And also relax. Several studies have said that stress is a major cause of mouth ulcers. It has a huge effect on the immune system and could be a cause of recurrent mouth ulcers. So use relaxation techniques such as guided imagery. That appears to help. And when, you know, there's loads of meditation apps and things like that available now, or meditation classes even online in these current circumstances. So you could try sort of researching that and finding something that's really comfortable and relaxing for you to do. I think stress is a cause of a lot of things, really, isn't it? So stress has got a lot to answer for, so we should be getting it under control as much as we possibly can. And another problem that is very common is cataracts. You know, eyes are very, very precious, aren't they, in this day and age? And we really need to be taking care of our eyesight as much as possible. Cataracts are cloudy, opaque patches into the lens of the eye. They're more common as you get older, but they're not necessarily inevitable. What you eat and your lifestyle can play a big part into whether you get cataracts or not. So there are certainly a lot of things you can do to help prevent them. So one of the things is eating a healthy diet. Healthy diet, you know, will fix many things to a certain degree. So a diet that's rich in a variety of vitamins and minerals, it can protect against cataracts. In particular, make sure you get plenty of antioxidants, including lutein, zeaxanthin, vitamin C and E, beta carotene and zinc. People with higher intakes of these nutrients are significantly less likely to have cataracts. Fill your plate with lots of colourful fruit and veggies and you should be on the right track. But, you know, you can also take a combination antioxidant supplement for, you know, just for safekeeping. And if you're deficient in vitamin B2, that's been linked to cataracts as well. And one trial found that older people taking a combination of vitamin B2 and B3 supplements had a 44% reduced risk of nuclear cataracts, which is the most common form. Vitamin B12 is also an important cataract preventer, according to research. Try to include lots of vitamin B-rich foods in your diet, such as salmon, beef, organ meat, sunflower seeds, eggs, and mushrooms, and consider a high quality B complex supplement as well for added protection. And green tea. A large study in China found that green tea drinkers had a significantly lower risk of age-related cataracts compared to non-drinkers. Green tea is high in vision-supporting antioxidants, and drinking at least 500 mils per day, which is roughly 2 cups, should have a protective effect, the researchers said. And a number of prescription drugs have been linked to cataracts, including antidepressants, hormone replacement therapy, that's HRT, statins, oral and inhaled corticosteroids, and anti-diabetes drugs. So try to avoid them if you can. And of course, smoking. Smokers are more likely to have cataracts. It's thought that the cadmium in cigarettes accumulates in the lens and causes damage. Plus, cigarette smoke is rich in free radicals, which can deplete levels of protective antioxidants. And of course, drinking. When it comes to cataracts, people who indulge in one or two alcoholic drinks a day appear to have the lowest risk compared to heavy drinkers or teetotalers. Red wine may be the best choice as it's rich in antioxidants. And obese people are more likely to have cataracts, so staying in shape may be another way to keep your vision sharp. And again, that relates to having a healthy diet, doesn't it? So just make sure that your diet is good. And exposure to ultraviolet radiation can contribute to cataracts. So wearing sunglasses, ideally wrap-around ones when you're outdoors, might help to save your sight. The blue light emitted from computers, tablets and smartphones can also be harmful. So try to keep screen time to a minimum as well. So foods that are really good for cataracts are kale, which is rich in lutein, vitamin C and beta carotene. Spinach, which is rich in lutein, vitamin C, vitamin E and beta carotene. Egg yolks, which are rich in lutein and zeaxanthin. Kiwis, which are rich in lutein, vitamin C and vitamin E. Orange peppers, which are rich in zeaxanthin, vitamin C and beta carotene. Corn, that's maize, rich in lutein and zeaxanthin. Red grapes as well are really good because they're rich in lutein, zeaxanthin and beta carotene. And pumpkin seeds, which are rich in zinc, vitamin E and beta carotene. And finally, a cantaloupe melon, which is rich in vitamin C and beta carotene as well. So some really good natural things there that you can take to try and stave off the onset of cataracts. Right, we're going to take a little break now. And after the break, I'll be back with the final part of the show talking about your metabolism. Do you have a slow or fast metabolism? Or is metabolism all in the mind? Or the diet, even? Okay, well, I'll be back for more right after this.
Thank you.
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And we're talking metabolism. So there's a common misconception that you're born with either a great metabolism or a bad one. But it turns out that it's not set in stone. So you don't need to forever eliminate your favourite foods or just grin and bear it, really. It may be that you just need to clean out your liver so it can burn fat better. Now, the liver is the heaviest internal organ and the largest gland in your body. It's a powerful machine that can act as a filter to remove toxins, and it helps with the digestion and regulates hormones and blood sugar. The liver is responsible for processing everything you eat, and it also functions as your body's kind of storage system as well. Nutrients and fuel that you don't need today are stored in the system for later. So the surplus is essential because you never get exactly what you need each day. A healthy liver stores extra energy and doles it out later when you need it. Now, when your liver is unhealthy, your body tends to store fuel as fat, especially around your middle, and you can no longer tap into the nutrients you need to burn fat. This means that no matter which diet you choose or how hard you try, weight loss is pretty much impossible. Your liver stores fuel in two forms, glycogen and triglycerides. When it's healthy, it keeps a supply of each fuel with room to take on more. And triglycerides are the ultimate version of stored fuel. The liver can make them out of anything, carbs, fats, ketones, even alcohol. But glycogen is more particular. It can be made only out of carbohydrates and contains much less energy. But it has an advantage over triglycerides. The energy stored in glycogen is more readily available. It's easier to burn triglycerides for fuel when you have some glycogen to get the fire started. When the liver is overloaded with too many triglycerides, there is no more room for glycogen. And without glycogen, it's hard to burn triglycerides for fuel. When a load of new fuel comes in from the last meal and the liver is already clogged, all it can do is jam in even more triglycerides or send the fuel away to get stored as body fat. This is what creates a slow metabolism, a liver that's too overloaded to be able to store fuel temporarily. So every day there's different diets that tell us that there's good foods, there's bad foods, etc. And every day that seems to cancel out the previous day, really, doesn't it? So it gets very confusing. But basically, in fact, all carbs and ketones work collectively as fuel. A healthy liver can either store fuel or burn it. An unhealthy liver can only store it. So the good news is that healing your liver takes weeks, not months or years. And you can do it quite easily, really. But you have to do what you have to do is really take control of your diet. It's really interesting. It's a really interesting thing to do. And tests have been done on this as well. And people have been tracked, after changing their diet. And it's been seen that most achieved remission from diabetes as well, well before 8 weeks. And nearly everyone that was treated had fatty liver syndrome as well, because your organs can get fat on them. When the liver is overburdened by excess sugar, the body stores it as fat. And this can trigger a potentially devastating inflammatory response, which has been linked to heart disease and some forms of cancer. And new research suggests that fatty liver is not just a consequence of weight gain, it can also be the cause. So addressing fatty liver syndrome is crucial in the fight to both regain health and lose inches. So if we do this, if we change our diet slightly and use foods that keep the metabolism working, then we're going to find a big difference. So things that keep the metabolism working are vegetables such as beets, cabbage, dandelion greens and shiitake mushrooms. Good fats are pumpkin seeds, pistachios and almonds. And carbs with resistant starch are winter squash, boiled potatoes and haricot beans. Lean proteins such as salmon, clams, tempeh and poultry. Culinary spices such as turmeric, garlic, basil and ginger, and a combination of cruciferous vegetables such as broccoli, cauliflower and cabbage in conjunction with herbaceous vegetables like carrots, parsley and parsnips. And other great liver cleansers as well are papaya, garlic, onions, radishes, grapes and soy products. So there's lots of things that you can do, and lots of snacks that you can have with some of these things. And you know, it's interesting to see the results of changing a diet in this way. I mean, when they did the research, the program also cured a high percentage of people from high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and autoimmunity. And as liver function improved as well, weight loss happened naturally, mostly from the waist. And often it was the only step that people needed to regain their health. So it's really interesting if you go on this liver cleansing diet. Which you'll be able to find tonight. It's called the Metabolism Reset Diet, actually. And you can find this online. There are books about it. And it's really quite interesting. I mean, basically, it provides the right amount of fuel from carbohydrates and fat to prevent nutrient deficiencies while still prompting the liver to use its own supplies of stored fuel. After just a few weeks, you'll be able to eat reasonably healthily and maintain your weight without any special effort. And most people find they can be less restrictive with food than they were before and still reap the benefits of a well-functioning liver. And after liver function improves, people notice additional benefits like fewer food cravings, steady energy levels, less fluid retention and better digestion. And resetting your metabolism will help you get rid of high triglyceride levels by eating simple foods in the right ratios at the right times of the day. It's really interesting to kind of do something like this. Of course, it's all natural. There are no chemicals involved. And resistant starch is an important component of this particular diet because it helps the liver in breaking down triglycerides and speeds the rate that adipose tissue is converted into energy. So, you know, there's lots of different aspects to it, but basically it's about resetting your metabolism. And it's not easy to do. None of these things are easy to do, but it's certainly worth investigating. So, I mean, in general, people who struggle to lose weight often blame a slow metabolism. But then there's little evidence to actually support this claim. And research actually shows that overweight people have faster metabolisms than thinner people. Larger bodies require more energy to carry out basic bodily functions. So research suggests people tend to eat more than they think they do. And when asked to write down everything they've consumed in a day, many people tend to report eating far less than they actually do. So more often than not, the reason you're putting on weight isn't because of a slow metabolism. It's because you're eating and drinking more calories than you're burning. So it may be a little bit hard to accept, but staying on top of the number of calories you eat is key to losing weight and keeping it off. So and crash diets and other calorie restricted diets can slow your metabolism. So the liver cleanse diet is probably a pretty good one actually to stick on, because we're not thinking about calories in particular with that one. And with some diets, your body is forced to break down muscle to use for energy. So the lower your muscle mass, the slower your metabolism. So with less muscle and a slower metabolism, it then becomes a lot easier to put body fat back on after coming off the diet. But it's claimed that certain foods and drinks can boost your metabolism. I've named a few, so there's green tea as well, black coffee, spices and energy drinks. But the evidence behind those few is weak. I mean, green tea is certainly good for you. Energy drinks, but I wouldn't really recommend those at all. So, I mean, basically, it's thought that you don't have an awful lot of control over the speed of your metabolism, but you can control how many calories you burn through your level of physical activity. So the more active you are, the more calories you burn. And some people who are said to have a fast metabolism are probably just more active and maybe a bit more fidgety than others. So if you've tried dieting, if you've tried the liver cleanse, or if you try getting rid of your fatty liver, and that's well worth trying, really, to speed up your metabolism. You know, you'd maybe need to do a little bit more exercise. Aerobic exercise is the most effective way to burn calories. And you should aim to do at least 150 minutes of aerobic activity, such as walking or cycling and swimming when we're able to again in a week. And you can achieve this target by doing 30 minutes 5 days a week and breaking down your activity sessions into chunks of 10 minutes. To lose weight, you're likely to need to do more than 150 minutes a week and make changes to your diet. And also, muscle burns more calories than fat, so increasing your muscle mass will help you to lose weight. So aim to work all the major muscle groups, the legs, hips, back, abdomen, chest, shoulders and arms, on two or more days a week. And examples of muscle strengthening activities include lifting weights and high intensity bouts of exercise. Heavy gardening may also do the job. And try to make activity part of your daily routine. That could include walking or cycling, or all are part of your journey to work. And you could also take the stairs instead of the lift. So it's about getting more active. So yeah, we can't just blame our metabolisms, although they could have slowed down a bit because of our livers. Once you've exhausted all sources, all supplies, or all options, should I say, then I think it's probably time to look at diet, exercise overall. There's always reasons, isn't there, why these things happen. So it's getting to the source, isn't it, rather than treating the symptoms. We've got to treat the actual, the problem itself. So anyway, I hope you found this week's show good. I hope it's inspired you to do something positive for your body and for yourself. So until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.